Chapter 119. Asim leads Jiang Lijun into the single-story stone building, glad to see the Chinese intelligence officer being quiet and humble. For too long, this foreigner had his hands on the proverbial purse strings, dispensing money and weapons and supplies when it suited Jiang and his masters. But now Asim is in charge. He will show Jiang the most sought woman on the planet, Mel Keating, the president's daughter, and will show Jiang the power of his hand and blade. Then the Chinese man will be let loose. Asim has lied many times over the years during his jihad, but at least this time he is telling the truth. "Come, come," Asim says, "and in a very few minutes you will be free." Asim goes past the old stalls, stocked with supplies and piled weapons, and lit from above by single light bulbs, and past two of his warriors, squatting, sipping cups of tea. He frowns upon recalling how much Faraj enjoyed the infidel's alcohol, and he stops at the locked wooden door to Mel's cell. Another of his armed warriors nods and steps aside. Asim looks to Jiang. The Chinese intelligence officer's face is blank. Asim produces the key, unlocks the door, and pushes it open. It halts. He pushes again. It grinds a bit and stops again. "What is going on?" Asim wonders. "You," he says to a warrior, "help me get this door open." The warrior slings his AK-47 over his shoulder and joins Asim in pushing the door open. It takes a few long seconds, and then something breaks free and the door swings in. Asim quickly sees what happened. Mel inserted a piece of broken wood under the bottom of the door, blocking it. "Didn't work, did it, Mel?" Asim says, walking in. The cell is empty. Mel isn't there. "What?" he shouts, stunned. He sweeps the room and sees a pile of dirt and something wiggling, and a pair of feet are disappearing up into a hole.
Chapter 120. Shoving that piece of wood underneath the door gave Mel a few precious seconds, and yes, it worked, it worked. It worked. She kicks with her feet, uses her elbows again, and her head is through, hands up, and on the loose rock and dirt part of this roof. And she squirms and feels like a damn cork popping out of a champagne bottle. Mel rolls to her side, flattens out, takes a few quick breaths. Out. Now what? The mountain here is nearly a sheer cliff. And the road is out. Too easy to be spotted. And that flat place over there with the stone wall? No. Too exposed. There's a mess of broken rocks and boulders off to the other side of the compound, and it looks easier to get there. Lots of places to hide and maneuver. She has the bottle of water stuck in her clothes, and she still has slippers on her feet from that sweet old woman who took her in. Mel crawls to the edge of the roof, peers down, sees nobody moving around, though that's going to change in less than a minute or two, when a seam races out and starts raising hell. She moves around, lowers herself down as quietly as she can, dangling, her hands on the sharp stone edge of the roof. Mel drops to the ground, happy that she remembers at the last second to drop on her good foot, not her injured one. Then, she starts running to freedom.
Chapter 121. Jiang Lijun steps forward into the cell. Ahead of him is the guard with the AK-47, and in front of the guard is Asim, reaching up with both hands, trying hard to grab Mel Keating's quickly disappearing feet. Jiang takes it all in and moves quickly. Hand under his vest and shirt, past two energy bars and a water flask, he grabs a ceramic tube, invisible to metal detectors. Pulls it out, places the butt end against the base of the skull of Asim's guard, quickly pulls a plastic ring on the end of a nylon cable. Thump. The single-shot weapon fires a .32-caliber slug into the man's head, instantly killing him. He drops. Asim starts turning around. Jiang tugs at the dead man's AK-47. The sling is tangled up. Asim doesn't say a word, just reaches into his vest and pulls out his knife. Jiang gets the AK-47 free, but it's in the wrong position. The muzzle end facing Jiang, the butt facing Asim, who is coming at him. One of Jiang's training officers many years ago. Run to a gun. Run away from a knife. Jiang punches the wooden stock end of the AK-47 into Asim's forehead, and Asim stumbles back, falls down. Jiang races from the cell, closes the door, wishes he had the key. Wastes 2 seconds looking for something to tie off the door or block it. Nothing. He lowers his head, puts the AK-47 over his shoulder, starts walking down the corridor, past the stalls, past the piles of supplies, past the 2 armed men sipping tea, who thankfully ignore him. Outside into the cold night air. Looks as though someone has hauled away the body of Faraj, and Jiang is happy about that. For Faraj was one smart fellow who figured out what really happened when Asim's family was killed. Good he's gone. But where is Mel? She wouldn't go to the road. Too far away, too many men walking around. And she is slight and small and would stand out as she's not carrying a weapon. There, to the east, where there's a mess of boulders and rough rocks leading down into an incline. Jiang moves out. Also hidden in his vest is a transponder. Once he grabs Mel and flips the switch, a contract team with a helicopter will be heading out to pick them up and fly them both back to the Chinese embassy and to safety. He pulls out one more tool, a small night vision monocular, and he puts it up to his left eye and there she is, just as he thought, heading to the rocks.
Chapter 122. After the weeks of fear, sadness, and terror, I'm in place. I'm in position. I'm with Alejandro and Nick near the 4 pickup trucks, keeping watch on the west side of the building where Mel is being kept. The 2 oil drums are still ablaze, 3 or 4 armed men clustered around them trying to stay warm. Other men walk in and out of the 3 stone buildings nearby, all carrying weapons. No innocence here, I think. Save my girl. Matt, this is David, he says over the radio. David, go, I say. Claire and I are in position, he whispers. Just to let you know, there's activity at the main door. Armed tangos going in and out. I say, David, is Mel visible? Negative, Matt, David says. No sighting of Mel. Copy, I say. Crew, light him up. We all switch on our infrared lasers, which are invisible to the naked eye, but visible with our NVGs and deadly useful for pinpointing our targets. Instantly, 5 thin rods of light flare out and target 5 armed men near the building. I say, we go in 3, starting now. Copy is repeated to me 4 times in 4 different voices. 3, I say. My little girl, Mel, 5 or 6, screeching because she fell into a fire ant nest, running at me with arms held out. Daddy, daddy, daddy. 2, I say. Mel at 12, falling off a horse while taking lessons, lying motionless on the ground for long, cold seconds until I see her start to move as I run across the dirt corral. 1, I say. Mel swimming at Lake Marie with heavy dark clouds on the horizon, and a bolt of lightning strikes a tree across the way, and me getting into a canoe and frantically paddling to her with her laughing as I get to her. Dad, what's the worry? I say, go. We attack in a standard L-shaped ambush, with Claire and David eliminating any threat by the main door, and with us 3 current and former SEALs taking out everyone within the kill zone to the west of the building. There's muffled thud-thud-thuds, for we're all using sound suppressors on our M4s. 5 men fall, and then 2 more, and David says via my earpiece, "Main door clear, Matt." "Copy that," I say, and Nick and Alejandro join me in moving quickly across the open rock and dirt field, Claire and David providing us with cover as we get to the door. Technically and morally speaking, we've just killed 7 men, and all I can think is, better you than me and my crew and my daughter. We get to the heavy wooden door with large hinges, and Alejandro gets to work quick, and we ignore the 2 bodies sprawled on the ground. He slaps a breaching charge on the lock, and we turn away as it snaps and flares to life, and then Nick grabs the door handle and pulls it open. Alejandro is right behind Nick and tosses in 1 flashbang grenade and then another, and the heavy thump-thump seems to explode right out of the front door. No doubt whoever's still alive out there in the other buildings will come running out to investigate and will be cut down by David and Claire. Nick goes in, pivots left. Clear! Alejandro pivots right. Clear! I move down a stone hallway, smelling the burnt firecracker odor of the flashbang grenades, proceed past piles of weaponry, pallets of weapons, 1 or 2 light bulbs still burning after the blast of the flashbangs, and A man comes out from one of the stalls, blinking his eyes, dragging an AK-47. Training, experience, and memory all come back. I shoot him in the forehead and twice in the chest. I pivot left, blanket and rations and teapot. Clear, I call out. Nick and Alejandro follow me, and there's another 3 rounds fired off nearby. And Nick says, clear. Up ahead is another door. It's ajar. Alejandro throws his shoulder against it, and the door opens wide, and shit, 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 and I cry out, Mel! Seeing a body on the ground, blood around the head, thinking, too late, oh shit, we're too late. Nick kneels down and says, Matt, it's a guy, no worries. I give the room a quick glance, dirt in a corner. I walk forward, look up. A chimney or sluice pipe or something has been cleared free. Was Mel here? Or has she been taken away? Alejandro says, sir, over here. He's pointing to a flat rock about a meter in width and height, part of the far wall. Letters and numbers have been painted there. MK603. Nick says, her initials maybe, but the numbers? 603, I say. New Hampshire's area code. I touch the letters. They feel sticky to the touch. Fruit or berry or something. My clever, clever girl. Looks fresh, I say. Guys, she was here. She was here just a while ago. Let's get moving. We move in a single line, Nick taking the lead, me in the middle, Alejandro pulling up the rear. I say, Claire, David, this is Matt. Go, they both reply. Mel was here, but it looks like she might have escaped, I say. David, work the stone wall to the south. Nick and Alejandro will work the buildings and the area to the west. I'll head east to that rocky area. Claire, get on top of this building and give us overwatch. A chorus of copies, and then we burst outside, and we split up to find my daughter, and I think again, clever girl, but please, God, not too clever. We've got to find her in the next few minutes before our Tunisian pilot comes back to retrieve us, because I'm not boarding that Black Hawk without her.
Chapter 123. After it happens, about 30 seconds after getting off the roof of the old stables, Mel Keating thinks it's her damn lousy night vision that screws everything up. She hasn't gotten far when she freaking bumps into somebody walking in the darkness. And she tries to spin around and keeps on strolling, but the guy says something. She ignores him, keeps on walking. Another burst of Arabic, and then crap, crap, crap. A second armed guy joins the chorus, and they grab her and feel her up, and one and then the other realizes who they have. She struggles, squirms, tries to kick them both, but they are strong and hold her and start dragging her back to the buildings. And one starts yelling, Hasher! 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 And just like in those damn horror movies where the monster comes out of the darkness to get you, an angry Asim al-Ashid strides into view, carrying a small tactical flashlight, an armed guy following him. He speaks in quick Arabic to the two jerks holding her, and then he says, Mel Keating, you're about to get what you deserved since your miserable birth. Two explosions echo out and startle them all. And there's muffled gunfire, and Mel yells to him, not knowing for sure but wanting to taunt the bastard. Speaking of getting what you deserve, hear that, asshole? It's my dad and his buds coming to get me and kill you all. And like magic, she hears at the same time a whiz, splat, grunt. And the man holding her to the left drops, and then another whiz, splat, grunt. And the guy behind a seam falls to the ground. And she falls and rolls and starts crawling away from all the gunfire. Those rocks, she thinks. Good place to hide out until Dad or the SEALs or the Rangers or whoever's out there makes their presence known. Mel continues to crawl on the rough dirt and rock, keeping her head down.
Chapter 124. Nick Zeppos and Alejandro Lopez work their way around to the west side of the building, and Claire announces through their respective earpieces, Eyes open, guys. Two nearest buildings to you. Lots of tangos running out. Nick says, Copy. And the NSA chick sure isn't fooling, because the three buildings nearest to where Mel was kept, damn, the place is swarming with armed guys coming out of doors and side entrances and even one open window. Best cover they can get is a slight dirt berm, and they drop down and get to work. It's not much cover because every time they take out a guy running out of one of the houses yelling, Allahu Akbar, and spraying widely with machine gun fire, two others fly out, taking up positions around the rocky ground near the buildings. These tangos start firing, and bits of dirt and rock fly up as they strike the berm that Nick and Alejandro are hiding behind. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. He and Alejandro keep up a steady and calm fire. Nick says, "Changing mags," when his bolt action snaps back and he pops out the empty magazine, slams a full one into the M4, releases the bolt, and resumes firing, following the thin guiding rod of his infrared laser sight. A few seconds later, Alejandro echoes Nick's actions, saying, "Changing mags," and Nick keeps focused, lasing one target after another, hearing a loud crack as Claire on Overwatch takes down one of the Tangos. Initially, the fighters out there come running out in the typical spray-and-pray pattern, holding up their AK-47s and emptying the entire magazine in one frightened trigger pull. But a few over there know what they're doing and are firing back with hard, disciplined fire. Alejandro says, "We'd love to have a warthog up there." "Yeah, make it two," Nick says. He spots something sparkling coming at them and yells, "Grenade!" and huddles up, holding his helmet down, and blam! He looks up, sees another set of sparkles. Blam! "Shit," Nick says, resuming his position, returning fire, taking down one, and then another Tango trying to rush their positions. It's too quiet at his right. Nick whirls. Alejandro is curled up on his side. Nick rolls over and says, "Al, you okay? You okay?" He groans. "You estupido. Do I look okay?" Alejandro groans again. "Piece of shrapnel nailed my right wrist. Feels like the fucker's broken. Help me get my Sig Sauer out." Nick works quickly, tugging out Alejandro's pistol from his holster, hands it over to his partner. He gets his M4 back up in time to take down two Tangos who were only 2 meters away. Thud, thud, thud. Nick says, "Claire, this is Nick. We need more cover fire." Two more shots from his M4. A sharper sound as the wounded Alejandro uses his 9mm pistol. "Claire, we need help over here." But Claire doesn't answer.
Chapter 125. Jiang Lijun stays low, moving zigzag, knowing that the Americans are here, but he's still determined to grab Mel Keating first and to bring her to safety, for the benefit of his country and his career. But he has to be careful because there's a huge firefight breaking out over to the west, and he doesn't want to be caught up in any crossfire between the Americans and Asim's men. The Americans would shoot him because he's a male carrying an AK-47. And Asim's men would shoot him just because they're scared now and shooting at everything that looks threatening. He takes cover behind a pile of scrap metal and crushed oil barrels, and he scans and scans with his monocular NVD. And yes, there she is, hiding behind those two cracked boulders. "Now." Jiang squirms ahead, and with the pile of scrap metal behind him, he gets closer and calls out, "Mel! Mel Keating! U.S. SEALs! Come on up, I can see you!"
Years back, Dad let her and Mom observe a night exercise, and man, that sure as hell seems like what's going on over there. Lots of gunfire, somebody's using a heavy caliber bolt-action fire, easy to identify because of the hard crack that's fired in a slow pattern, and now, grenades are being tossed around over there. "Mel!" a strong voice calls out. "Mel Keating? U.S. SEALs, come on up, I can see you!" Oh. What a wonderful flood of relief and joy rushes through her upon hearing her name, hearing who's here to rescue her. And it must be Dad's buds, ones who'd go anywhere at any time to rescue one of their own. "Coming," she says, and she scrabbles up the rocks, seeing a squatting shape, slightly outlined by the fires breaking out on the west side of the area. "Hurry, hurry," the man urges. "We need to get you out of here." "Don't I know it," she yells back, nearly laughing. "Almost there!"
And here she is, Jiang thinks. The president's daughter, after all this time, all the setbacks and travel, emerging from the broken boulders and rocks. "Here," he says, grabbing her hand. "This way." He holds her hand and she laughs, and then she digs in, tugs her hand free. "Who the hell are you?" she demands. Jiang says, "Navy SEALs. Which team?" "What? Which team?" she says, quickly backing away. "And that's an AK-47, not an M4 or an HK. And you don't have the right gear. Where's your helmet? Your NVGs?" Jiang grabs her collar as she tries to run away and wrestles with her. And she bites his hand and he says, "Damn it, girl. I'm trying to rescue you."
Up on the roof of the building where Mel was kept, Claire Boone of the NSA is having one hell of a good time, although she'd never admit that to anyone at the agency, especially at the debriefing that's coming her way when this unauthorized op wraps up. But this is like being the baddest, meanest cosplayer in the world, shooting evil guys from up on high. One of her problems with being on the spectrum is that her mind is always working, always racing, and she's thinking of the gamers she knows in the community. And maybe she could go to a couple of them with an investment and an idea for a single-shooter game, called Overwatch, of course. She sweeps the southern side of the area, sees Secret Service agent David Stahl behind that small and crumbling rock wall, and he looks okay. And then she sweeps over to the west, and boy, those two SEAL guys are really in a hole. And she fires off three rounds, the spent brass tinkling on the rock roof. Claire wants to keep pouring fire on those jerks threatening Nick and Alejandro, but she has responsibilities up here, she sure does, and she rolls herself around so she's facing east, and she easily makes out the IR laser sight coming from Matt Keating, the former president. She still can't believe she's with him, and she scans and stops cold. A guy holding an AK-47 in one hand is fighting someone smaller, lighter, and God be praised, with long hair. She carefully aims her way to the slug, and there are voices in her earpiece, and she ignores them as she gently pulls the trigger, as she's done thousands of times before in practice and in real life. This crazy cold night in the mountains of Libya is as real as it gets.
Chapter 126. Claire's calm voice in my earpiece stops me cold in my search, which has been going on for long, empty minutes spent scanning, kneeling down, looking behind and in front of me, all the while trying to tamp down the fear that's saying to me, "Suppose you can't find her." Claire says, "Matt, just took down an armed tango who was holding Mel. She's about 30 meters to the east of where I'm located near a pile of scrap metal. Go get her. Go get her." I turn my head and spot the scrap metal Claire's pointed out. About a second ago, I was tired, hip aching, frustrated, and fearful. And now I feel like I'm 20 years younger as I race toward where Mel is. Go get her. Those words will burn joy inside me forever, along with memories of the instructors yelling out, "Congrats, gents, Hell Week is over!" Of Samantha saying, "I do." Of the doctor calling out, "She's a girl and she looks fine." And of Samantha kissing me hard one late night in Texas and whispering, "Congratulations, Congressman." I run and run, my weapon still in my hands, and I'm scanning and looking, and as I get closer to that scrap metal pile, I yell out, "Mel, it's Dad! Stay put! I'll be there in a second!" Go get her. I round the pile of rusted metal and oil drums, and there's a body slumped over to the far left, and someone else hunched over near me like she's trying to burrow into the ground, and I race up, and just a few feet away, I say, "Mel, it's Dad! Let's go! Mel, it's me!" The shape pops up, and I whirl around, and it's Asim al-Rashid. And as I raise my M4 to fire, I feel his knife stab deep into me.
Chapter 127. Secret Service agent David Stahl hears the firefight going on about 70 or so meters away, but he focuses on his job, which is sweeping this long and slow crumbling stone wall, and so far, there's nothing. Through his headset, he hears the calm chatter of the two SEALs and Claire. The NSA woman up there coolly firing off 308 full metal jacket rounds at the terrorists trying to get to Nick and Alejandro. In about 1 minute, David is calling off this search and going back to the compound. Claire's calm voice brings a smile to his face and sends a warming joy throughout his cold and tired body. "Matt," she says, "just took down an armed tango who was holding Mel. She's about 30 meters to the east of where I'm located, near a pile of scrap metal. Go get her." David toggles the transmit switch on his radio. "Matt, this is David. Do you need me?" He keeps low, starts going back up the stone wall, still taking cover because he doesn't know how many jihadists might be out here in these mountains, coming in to lend a hand to Asim al-Rashid and his fighters. "Matt, this is David. Can I assist?" Still no answer.
He stops. Claire, this is David. Do you have visual on Matt and Mel? She instantly replies, not at the moment. Last I saw, Mel had hit the dirt, and her dad was approaching. Both are behind a pile of scrap metal.
Break! Break!
Says the strained voice of Nick.
David! Could really use your help over here!
David is torn. His Secret Service responsibility is over there, with the former POTUS and his daughter. He really should move over there. But tonight, he's a Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. You never leave anybody behind, never refuse a request for aid.
Nick, on my way,
he says, and he starts running toward the sound of the guns.
Asim feels strength course through him as he knocks down the former president, the man's weapon flying out of his hands, even his radio gear tumbling away. Asim also feels the quick joy of having his knife cut into the man who killed his family. They are struggling near a mound of old metal and oil barrels, and being on top of the man, Asim quickly gauges he's old and out of shape. Oh, the weak infidel is struggling, holding on to Asim's wrists, but Asim is certain a few more seconds will end it. Even with his head throbbing from the attack from that damn Chinese spy, and Asim plans to take a week to kill him once he's found him. Asim feels the strength of righteous rage flowing through him. He pushes down on Matt Keating's wrists, and in the dark he says, "Just you and me, Matt Keating, and you have no Secret Service, no army, no drones, no satellites. It's like the days of old, the strong versus the weak. And after I kill you, I will go find your girl and kill her too." Asim pushes again, his entire weight on top of the president, knowing he's only moments away from breaking the man.
Chapter 128. My left wrist is burning something awful, and a small rational part of me knows that Asim has cut me right down to the bone. But the larger rational part of me is realizing the son of a bitch has me and has me good. He's muscular, he's been living in Spartan conditions these past few years, while I've grown soft in politics, and he has a burning rage coming down on top of me. My comm gear is off, my M4 is over there somewhere, and there's a knife and a Sig Sauer pistol by my feet, but both weapons could be back in the States for all the good they can do me. I have my left hand on Asim's right wrist, right hand on his left wrist, and maybe I'm woozy or adrenaline-fueled, but I'm sure starlight is glittering off that sharp knife in his right hand. I try pushing, kicking, sliding, but he matches me move for move as he pushes down harder on me. He's murmuring words of revenge and destruction and a lie, and I'm not paying attention to what he's saying, and I'm definitely not answering him because I can't spare the strength and the oxygen. It's easy to see what's going to happen. My cut left wrist is going to fail me in a few seconds, and with his knife hand free, he's going to go for my throat, and when he's sure I'm dead, he'll go hunting for Mel. I finally decide to yell out, "Mel, run for it! Get out of here! Head to the rock wall to the south!" Oh, damn, that drew some strength from me, and Asim laughs, starts spouting again about revenge and death, and yes, my left wrist is weakening, it's hurting, and I know I'm just seconds away from calling it a night. It's almost peaceful. It'll be quick, and Mel will join up with the others, and she'll be safe. But I keep on fighting. Wonder if I'm going to get a state funeral. The first ex-POTUS not to die in bed. Asim whispers, "Give up, Matt Keating. Give up. I promise to make it quick. Quicker than when you killed my wife and my daughters." I try twisting and pulling his other hand away, but his strong wrist barely moves. If I pull away now and try to put both hands on the hand holding the knife, he'll just use his other hand to throttle me. A younger me would be able to lift him up with my legs and throw him off balance, but I'm no longer the younger me. Soon, I'll no longer be me. "Mel!" I yell for the last time. "Run!" Blood is streaming down my wrist, which wobbles, weakens, and it's close. Very close to bending. Thud. Asim gasps and falls back. Freed, I quickly sit up, pull my Sig Sauer, and I'm on top of him now and press the muzzle end of my pistol right under his chin and I say, "You talk too much." And I pull the trigger twice, blowing off the top of his head. I sit back exhausted. A shadow comes forward, holding a long piece of metal. A tentative voice, "Dad, is that you?" I say, Oh, Mal, yes, yes, it's me. And we hug and both sob, and the dad part of me just doesn't want to let her go, but the SEAL part, are there more bad guys out there? And Jesus, my wrist hurts, says, come on, hon, let's get you out of here. Chapter 129. Mel helps me get my gear back, and with my comms set secure again, I say, break, break, this is Matt. I've got Mel. Pull back to the exfil point. Pull back to the exfil point. She starts to move, and I say, hold on. Get that rucksack off me, will you? Dad, are you hurt? Just a scratch, I say. Come on, Mel, hurry. The rucksack falls to the ground, and I say, open it up. Put what's in there on, and then we'll get out of here. She unzips the top, pulls out a bullet-resistant vest, which I help her put on, and then a small ballistic helmet, which she gets on without my help. Now that she's dressed for a fire zone, I put my bleeding left arm around her and start moving as quick as possible, still keenly aware of my surroundings, my M4 in my right hand. The amount of gunfire is sharply dropped, meaning that most of Asim's men are dead, wounded, or have headed up into the mountains for safety. I spot our exfil point, and through my NVGs I see movement there and two IR laser beams probing out, exploring for emerging targets. Matt, coming in, I call out as I clamber over the lone stone wall, and Mel is with me, and she instantly says, my dad's hurt. Can someone help him? David comes over, and Mel closes in and says in an excited, incredulous voice, Agent Stahl? Is that you? He kneels in front of me, starts cutting away my BDU shirt sleeve, and says, of course, Mel. Just because you're halfway across the world doesn't mean we won't come to protect you. Then to me, Jesus, Matt, what'd you do to yourself? I say, got cut by a seam. David pours water over my wound, and I wince and turn away, and he says, where is he now? In another place, trying to explain what he's been doing these past years. I'm tired, and my wrist is hurting. Feels red hot, but Mel is sitting right next to me, protected. And I look down the length of the wall and see that Nick is keeping watch on the compound. A bandaged Alejandro is doing the same, and Claire Boone is checking out another person? David, I say, who's that with Claire? We're not taking prisoners. He presses a wad of quick-clot combat gauze to my wrist to stop the bleeding, and then starts tightly wrapping a compression bandage against the wound. You'll need some serious stitches once we get back to Tunisia. Yeah, I'm sure, but who's the guy with Claire? David laughs. A Chinese national, claims to be a field rep for the China State Construction Engineering Corporation, complete with business card and official ID. Claire says she saw him tussling with Mel a few minutes ago, thought he was a bad guy, shot him, but he was wearing a vest, managed to break a few ribs. Claire heard him calling for help as she was coming back here. I flex my wrist. Still hurts. I check my watch. We've been on the ground for 55 very long minutes. Where in hell is our Black Hawk? I work my Motorola and switch frequencies and call out, Joe, this is Matt. Come in, please. Nick fires off a shot. Joe, this is Matt. What's your status? No reply. I say, damn it. Mel says, who's Joe? A Tunisian Special Forces pilot. He brought us in and he's supposed to take us out. He's just a little late, that's all. To David, I say, if we have to, we'll take one of their trucks. With regret in his voice, he says, sorry, Matt. They're pretty shot up now. A bunch of the fighters tried to take shelter behind them. The three of us pretty much ventilated all of them. Great, I think. Just great. What now? I put my uninjured arm around Mel, give her a quick squeeze. Then as the wind shifts, I faintly hear the finest sound an operator amidst enemy territory can ever hear, the thrumming sound of helicopter rotors. Rescue coming in, courtesy of Sikorsky Aircraft. Prep for exfil, I call out, and take out two infrared chem lights, break them to activate the chemicals, and toss them out into the small, flat, stony area. Invisible to the naked eye, to Joe and his co-pilot's NVGs, they'll be a beacon they can't miss. Nick and Alejandro do the same as me, and for the Tunisian Special Forces guys up there, it must look like Times Square at night down here. A few minutes more, hon, I say to Mel. Just a few minutes more. Mel doesn't say anything, and I quickly become worried. But I listen harder and just hear my daughter sobbing into me.
Chapter 130. Faraj Al-Ashid knows he's dying, but he also knows he has bought himself several more minutes on Earth due to having quickly moved after his cousin stabbed him. That filthy dog. Instead of instantly killing Faraj, the wound is just an eventually mortal one.
mortal despite how much he has tried to bandage himself. He's crawling to where he thinks the Americans are hiding, for their insolent voices are loud indeed, carrying easily in this cold, thin air. He doesn't dare stand, and he doesn't dare move quickly, but move he does, dragging an AK-47 in his right hand. Oh, Allah, how it hurts in his chest. As he crawls along the rough ground, closer to the stone wall, final memories come to him of his childhood in Tripoli, of staying alive during the civil wars and militia drive-bys, of getting that film school scholarship, of living in Paris and learning so much, and of committing haram, fornicating with the willing whores and drinking and eating forbidden foods. Jihad, to which his cousin felt called, seemed like a road to redemption, something to eventually save his soul. But after years of bloodshed and combat, Faraj was tired of it, wanted to escape. But Asim, that, Ibn the Sharmuta, stopped him. Oh, it hurts so much. The sound of the helicopter grows louder. The aircraft is ready to rescue the Americans and perhaps even Mel Keating, take them back to their comfort and their secure lives. One more memory comes to him before he leaves this world for the dark unknown out there. He remembers the training classes for the raw recruits who found their way to his cousin's many camps and compounds. The first things Asim showed the young men were videos of the many jihad attacks over the years, from the USS Cole attack to the American embassy bombings in Africa and the sweet success of the fall of the Twin Towers in Manhattan and subway and bus attacks in London and other attacks in Brussels and Paris and Berlin. Faraj watched the rapt expressions of those young men and heard their laughter and cheers at seeing civilians being torn to pieces or falling to their deaths from the tall buildings, and he didn't see holy warriors then or now. Just young men with no future who took delight in breaking things, killing people, stomping on creatures. What Faraj learned in Paris as a young and vulnerable man, what is called nihilism. It now makes sense. He picks up the AK-47, ensures that the safety is off, and as the helicopter descends, he gets to his feet and pulls the trigger, enjoying those very last moments of being a killer.
Chapter 131. Our exfil flight is late, but at least it's here, and I raise my voice and say, "Get Mel in first, then Alejandro and the Chinese guy, and we'll follow." The light sticks scatter as the Black Hawk descends, dirt and gravel flying at us, and then it all goes to hell. Gunfire erupts from the grounds beyond us, and I turn, and so does Nick. And through my NVGs and infrared laser spotter, I see a wobbly man firing off an AK-47, and Nick and I shred him to pieces as Mel screams, "Daddy, I'm hit!" Bodies tumble here and there, and the gunman gets off a few more rounds before he falls into the dirt, and Mel is pulled from underneath someone, and she's pushed into the helicopter. Claire helps the Chinese man aboard, and I shove Alejandro inside, and David is on the ground, and Nick and I drag him in, and then the helicopter flares up and out, and the Tunisian crew chief slides the door shut. Our pilot, Joe, yells from up front, "So sorry we're late. Comm problems for real. Tried to fix them, and then we gave up and came in." I don't answer. I'm stepping frantically over legs and arms, getting to Mel, her face pale behind her eyeglasses. Claire is tearing off Mel's worn and filthy Dartmouth sweatshirt. I ache thinking of the last time I saw this shirt, that sunny, impossible day back at Lake Marie when Mel was safely heading off for a hike. And Claire looks and prods and says, "It's okay, Mr. President. I mean, Matt, shit. She's going to be okay. It looks worse than it is." Mel turns and says, "Claire Boone? What the hell are you doing here?" Claire paused through an open first aid kit from the Black Hawk, "Taking part in the rescue of your perky butt, it seems." The helicopter gains altitude and speed, and I have to smile at seeing Mel and Claire together. I turn, and I'm not smiling anymore. David Stahl is on his back, helmet off, eyes open, mouth slowly working, his skin graying out. Nick is frantically trying to run an IV into David's bare arm, and Alejandro is desperately trying with just one hand to stop the bleeding from the large wound to David's neck. I kneel and nudge Alejandro aside, and after Nick gets the needle in and stands up and hangs the IV bag from an overhead cable, he sees me and says, "I saw it all, Matt. The shooting started and David tossed Mel to the ground and threw himself on top of her, just like the Secret Service for sure." I push a wad of quick-clot combat gauze against David's wound and press another one on top, and that quickly soaks with blood, and I put another one on and another one on, and they all soak through within seconds. Alejandro whistles loudly toward the cockpit and says, "Joe, get this bird moving. Any town or village nearby with a hospital, get us there. Haul ass." Nick helps me with putting additional bandages and compresses on David's wound, but we exchange a look, and we know with cold certainty what's going to happen shortly as David's skin color starts to fade even more. His flickering eyes focus on me, and he whispers, "Hope, hope, hope." Nick says, "That's right, don't give up. Keep hoping, pal. We're going to get you to a clinic real soon now. Hang on, David, keep hoping." My eyes tear up, and I say, "No. He's using Mel's Secret Service code name. I'm Harbor. My wife is Harp. And Mel is Hope." I look up and yell, "Mel, get over here now!" She tries her best to keep her balance, her upper arm bandaged as the helicopter increases its speed. Claire follows her, the chopper jumping and jerking, and Mel kneels down next to David, and I said, "David, look, she's here. Mel is safe. Hope is safe. You did your job." Mel starts quietly crying and takes his right hand, squeezes it, and I take his left hand and do the same. I say, "David, good job. You saved my daughter. You saved Hope." His eyes flicker. He smiles. He whispers, "Good." Then he dies.
Chapter 132. Georgetown University, Washington, D.C. Raleigh Spruce is a grad student at Georgetown, studying at the Georgetown University Law Center. But tonight, he's working a double shift as a bartender at a convention being held at the university's hotel and conference center. His feet hurt, his mouth is dry from last night's partying, and his hands shake a bit as he mixes cocktails and draws various beers for the convention attendees crowding the joint tonight. Thing is, though, these guys, archaeologists and other types of dirt diggers, may be experts in their fields, but they're also experts at nursing drinks for hours and then tipping as if they, not him, were impoverished grad students. Years back, in Vermont, Dad told him, "Raleigh, learn a good trade like bartending. You'll always find work. In good times, people like to drink, and in bad times, they like to drink even more." Good advice. And some nights, he really does rake in the tips. But this night sure looks like another bust. He's taking a minute to wash and rinse some cocktail glasses at his station when a woman sitting at the table in the near corner starts screaming loudly. "What the?" he says, and he leans over the bar to see what the hell is going on. And then there's yells, shouts, applause, and the woman who was screaming just a moment ago is being hugged and kissed by a hell of a lot of people. One of the guys breaks away from the table and comes rushing up to Raleigh and says, "Quick, bud, a bottle of champagne. Best you got. Send it over to our table. Hell, champagne for everyone. Drinks on the house." Raleigh doesn't need to be told twice and gets to work as there's more cheering and applause. He sees that lots of people are standing, looking at the television set up above the bar. A few minutes ago, it was showing a Washington Nationals baseball game, but now there's a news anchor from one of the networks, smiling and talking into the camera. Raleigh doesn't know what the hell is going on, but on the TV screen behind the news anchor is a photo of Mel Keating, the former president's daughter, whom Raleigh always thought was cute in a nerdy kind of way. And based on what Raleigh sees, it looks as though she's alive and was rescued somewhere in North Africa. Cool.
Raleigh thinks as he kneels down before the small refrigerator to check how many champagne bottles they have on ice. Looks as though it's going to be a good night after all.
Epilogue.
Chapter 133. Bangor International Airport, Bangor, Maine. We're flying home on a U.S. Air Force Boeing C-40 passenger jet provided to us following a happy phone call to Air Force Secretary Kimberly Bouchard, who quickly dispatched it to Sfecostina in Tunisia to pick us up. As we descend into Bangor, we remain short two passengers. First, the Chinese man who claimed to be from the China State Construction Engineering Corporation, innocently caught in the crossfire. Mel told me otherwise aboard our Black Hawk flight out of Libya, and I made sure that when we got back to Tunisia, the quiet and injured Chinese citizen was placed in the custody of a hard-looking man and equally hard-looking woman, who were supposedly State Department representatives from our embassy in Tunisia. They were to provide aid and assistance, of course, prior to his being brought to his country's embassy in Tunis. The other missing passenger, the remains of one brave and dedicated Secret Service Special Agent David Stahl, is flying several hours behind us on a C-17 transport plane heading to the Air Force Base in Dover, Delaware. It's been a quiet, long flight with rows of empty seats beside us. Nick and Alejandro have slept a lot and ate the Air Force in-flight food, standard fare. And Mel and Claire have spent a couple of hours catching up and playing who's gone where and what is so-and-so doing. Now Mel is stretched out across two seats, a blanket draped over her, her head in my lap as she sleeps, and hopefully doesn't dream. I've stayed awake most of the time. It's traditional among special forces to have a debrief following the end of a mission, but not this time. The only debrief is taking place in my memory. As I go over what happened, how it happened, could it have gone better? For though I'm grateful beyond words that my daughter is asleep in my lap, a terrible price was paid. The pilot comes over the intercom. Passengers, prepare for landing. A uniformed female senior airman comes through and wakes up Nick, Claire, and Alejandro, tells them to fasten their safety belts, and she comes to Mel and me and smiles and shakes her head. "You're fine, Mr. President," she says. "Thanks." After we land, we taxi some and the jet comes to a halt, and Mel wakes up, yawns, and I give her another hug and say, "Hold on, I nearly forgot to give this back to you." From my pants pocket, I take out her gold ring, her 16th birthday gift from her mother, and I slip it on her finger and her eyes tear right up. "Dad. God, I was dreading telling Mom that I might have lost it." "Well, now you don't have to." The forward door is opened, and a mobile stairway is rolled up. Nick and I try to help Mel down the stairs, but she shakes us off. "I'm hurt, guys, not crippled." She goes down to the tarmac by herself, holding tight to the guardrails. A black Chevrolet Suburban with tinted windows is waiting nearby, engine running. Nick, Alejandro, and Claire walk over to it, carrying their black duffel bags, and Mel and I follow them. Hugs and handshakes are exchanged. My wrist is aching, but doing okay. And I say to them, "I can't tell you how much my wife and I owe you. We're in your debt. Forever." Nick says, "No worries, sir. It was good to settle accounts for Boyd Tanner's capture and crucifixion. A few years late, but we took care of it, didn't we? Besides, we were never here. Or there. Alejandro and I were on leave. He hurt his arm doing something. Officially, that's what happened." One more round of handshakes. "Safe travels," I say. "And for you too, Claire." To my daughter, Claire says, "You going to the Sidwell reunion this fall?" Mel says, "God, no." "Good. Neither am I. Keep in touch, okay?" "Okay, girl." They enter the Suburban and drive away, and Mel slips an arm through mine, and we head to the few structures that make up Bangor International Airport. Around the quiet airport are a lot of pine trees. A knot of people come running out of the near building, clapping and cheering. and leading the race is my wife Samantha. And in seconds, she's smothering Mel, and then me, and then both of us. And so a precious and tearful few minutes pass. A wheelchair is brought up, and Mel says, "No, I don't need that." And her mother says, "You're sitting in that right now, young lady, and don't you say no." Mel shrugs and sits down and winces as her bandaged and slippered feet are put on the metal stand. And I see that the smiling people around me are my Secret Service detail from Lake Marie. Agents Stacy Fields, Ron Dalton, Paula Chin, Emma Curtis, and Nicole Washington. Agent Washington, who accompanied David Stahl and me when we escaped from Mary's Donner, and who sped out with our cell phones to lead FBI agents away from our trail, comes forward. I give her a hug and say, "You okay? You get caught?" She laughs. "No." And I'm disappointed I wasn't. Guess the FBI didn't track a thing. The agents all have black ribbons on their lapels. And it strikes me again the sacrifice and duty of David, over in Libya, a long, long way from home, where he could have stayed safe. But that wasn't David. Madeline Perry, my chief of staff, comes through and hugs me, then Mel, then Samantha. And with tears running down her cheeks, she says, "Oh, Mr. President, you did it. You did it. Welcome home. Welcome home, sir." I smile at her and say, "Sure as hell didn't do it by myself." She says, "Sir, you probably weren't expecting this so soon, but there's a huge media presence in the terminal." Samantha, standing behind Mel in her wheelchair, hands on Mel's shoulder, says, "How huge?" "More than 100. Sir, could you give a brief statement, please? Give them something now and they might leave you alone for the rest of the day." Mel is frowning and Samantha looks toward the terminal, shrugs and says, "Oh, why not?" We start moving toward the terminals, Samantha holding Mel's hand and me pushing the wheelchair, and we get into the lower part of the building, and there are Maine State Troopers and Bangor police officers to escort us in, each with a black band across his or her shield. I catch the eye of Agent Washington and say, "Nicole, do me a favor. Will you take over these pushing duties? I want a moment with my chief of staff." We switch off and I spot an empty office behind a pile of luggage. And I lead Maddie inside and we both sit down and she's still smiling. "Sir, welcome home. I can't wait to hear how you pulled this off and what happened over there." I say, "I still can't believe it myself." Maddie says, "I have to tell you. I've been getting texts all day from every major publisher in New York. Your book, an instant worldwide bestseller the moment you publish it." "I'm sure," I say. "But Maddie, just one thing before we start talking book deals." "Certainly, sir," she says, obviously happy, her eyes lit up. "What is it?" I say, "Maddie, why did you sabotage me?" Chapter 134. Bangor International Airport, Bangor, Maine. I have to give my tough chief of staff credit. She doesn't argue with me or deny it or say anything. But the light is gone from her eyes. She sits with me in this heavy silence in this small office. I say, "Just before we left to catch that tanker flight from Pease, I made 2 phone calls, one to Samantha and one to you, because I thought you deserved to know what I was doing. When we got to Pease, we almost weren't allowed to leave. The White House ordered the aircraft to stand fast. Who did you call? Richard Barnes?" Color seems to slowly drain from her face. "No," she says. "Felicia Taft, his deputy. I told her." I wait. "Why?" Her eyes swell up, moisten. "I was afraid for you, sir. Afraid you were going to get wounded, captured, or killed. That the mission might be a failure. That you might end up killing Mel instead of rescuing her. I didn't want your name, your legacy, to be a failure. If Mel was still alive, I thought, the professionals would be called in." "That was my decision to make, wasn't it?" I say. "Yes, sir. But I was also thinking about the future. The foundation you want to set up for vets. Without you, it would never happen. Thousands of vets would continue to suffer or die every year. I want to make this quick. My reunited family is waiting for me." I say, "Then make the book deal, Maddie, best you can. And then after the contract is signed and I start writing it, I want you to run the foundation. We're going to call it the Boyd Tanner and David Stahl Memorial Fund, and you'll be in charge. Maddie is confused. But sir, I stand up. That means you're out as my chief of staff. I can't trust you anymore, Maddie, but I can trust you to run this foundation. Do a good job in their memories. She just nods. I'm sorry, sir. Me too, I say, and then I leave. I follow a helpful Maine State trooper to where my family is waiting in a hallway outside the main terminal, and I can hear the hum of voices nearby. To Mel and Sam, I say, ready? And they both nod. We go out into the terminal, which has the ugliest black and white tiled floor I've ever seen, and as we become visible, loud applause and questions roar out. There's a small table with a forest of microphones set in the middle. Samantha wheels Mel up to the table, and I stand to Mel's left while my wife takes the other side. Finally, I raise my hand and say, quiet, please, quiet. I'll answer as many questions as possible, but you have to realize my family is pretty tired. I point to a news anchor from one of the local Portland stations. Go ahead. Mr. President, who joined you in this rescue mission, and can we talk to them? I say, well-trained friends of mine who helped me with the intelligence gathering, planning, and its execution. They've asked to remain anonymous, and I'm going to respect their wishes. Next. The brusque questioner is a male reporter from one of the cable networks, and he built his career on hunting down Keating administration scandals and not finding one, which made him even more suspicious. He asks, sir, isn't it true that by performing this risky and unauthorized mission, you're expressing your dislike and distrust of the Barnes administration? That question silences the room, and after a few seconds pass, I say, no. Next. Sir, it appears you're injured. How did that happen? I lift my wrist. Cut myself, that's all. Sir, is Asim al-Rashid dead, and did you have a hand in his killing? I say, Asim al-Rashid is now in a position where he won't hurt or kill any more innocents. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Did you ask the Barnes administration for permission before heading out to rescue your daughter? I smile. Didn't have the time. One more then, please. My pompous cable reporter friend butts in loudly again and says, sir, aren't you concerned that the Barnes administration will prosecute you under the Logan Act? I give them all a good smile and say, Jake, you know as well as I do that the Logan Act only applies to citizens conducting unauthorized diplomacy with a foreign power. I pause. Whatever I was doing in Libya was definitely not diplomacy. Lots of laughter at that. And when it dies down, I say, how about some questions for my daughter? She's the real hero here. The media instantly picks up on that, and I expect Mel to be Mel, and she doesn't disappoint. Mel, how are you feeling? Tired. Achy. My feet are a mess, and it looks like a bullet scraped my upper arm. Were you scared? Every damn second. Did you say thank you to your dad? Mel waits for a moment and says, boy, that's a dumb question. Anybody got a smart one? A few titters at that, and someone yells out, what food did you miss the most? Cheeseburgers, she says. I'm dying for a cheeseburger. Whose? Says a voice from the back. McDonald's? Burger King? In-N-Out? Come on, Mel says. There are no In-N-Out burger chains on the East Coast. And besides, my dad makes the best cheeseburgers in the world. I'll wait for his. Then it's Samantha's turn, and an anchor from a Boston channel says, Mrs. Keating, what are your plans now? That seems to catch Sam off guard because she lowers her eyes, gives her head a quick shake, and looks at me while answering. She's quietly weeping but smiling, and with a shock, I realize I'm doing the same thing. They say politicians should never cry in public, but now I don't care. We made it. I think it's time for a sabbatical to spend a lot more time with my family, Samantha softly says. A follow-up question. But we understand that just a few weeks ago you made a historic find in Maine, revealing the first Basque village ever to be found in North America. Don't you want to go back to your work? Again, her loving and calm look right at me. A few tears rolling down her cheeks. I look right back, loving her forever one more time. Both of us holding on to our daughter with love and gratitude. No, she says. That's what weekends and grad students are for.
Chapter 135. Permanent Mission of the People's Republic of China. New York, New York. In a crowded dining room in the mission building, Jiang Lijun is feeling stuffed and achy. His stomach is full after an 8-course meal given in his honor. Though the truth is, he doesn't feel very honorable. Not after what happened in Libya. He has 2 cracked ribs at his back, where the American sniper's bullet struck his bullet-resistant vest, and only with the luck of having turned at the last moment did the bullet merely glance off him and not kill him. The room is filled with red banners and decorations, and plate after plate has come out, from appetizers of bean curd and jellyfish to bowls of illegal shark fin soup and slices of Peking duck and vegetables and noodles. Overseeing the entire banquet is Jiang's boss, Li Baodong, who takes a smiling interest in Jiang's wife, Zhen, and their daughter, Li Na, who gurgles and laughs at all the attention. There are about 2 dozen mission members here, and smiles and waves come his way. And finally, when it seems as though Jiang and his family can go back to their condo, Li Baodong comes over and says to Zhen, "Sweet one, if I may, I need a few minutes alone with your hero." Zhen is bouncing Lina on her lap and feeding her tiny slices of tangerine, and she nods with pleasure. Jiang gets up and follows his boss, who goes through the mission's kitchen area and into a small, undecorated office with 2 chairs and a metal desk. Li Baodong winks as he settles down heavily in the chair behind the desk, pulls a bottle and 2 glasses from a lower drawer, and pours into each glass a dark-colored liquid. "A special huangjiu," he says. "Very expensive, very rare. Smuggled here via diplomatic pouch. Have a good swallow. You deserve it." Jiang does just that, and when he puts down the empty glass, Li says, "Enjoying yourself?" "Yes, but..." "But what?" "It's uncomfortable," Jiang says. Considering how you fucked up everything you touched," Li demands. "Weeks ago you were given a simple task. Go to those New Hampshire mountains and retrieve Mel Keating. Instead, you disobeyed my orders, went rogue on a personal mission of vengeance, and when you had a second chance to do your job, you screwed up that one as well. You damn fool. You were supposed to rescue that girl and put the Americans in our debt and thaw our relations. But instead, you put us in debt to the Americans by allowing yourself to be captured and treated by their intelligence agencies in Tunis before being released to us. A laughing stock you are, boy. That's what you've done." "But I didn't say a word to them." Li says, "You didn't have to. No doubt they took high-quality photos of your facial features, not to mention gathered your fingerprints and DNA samples. Right now they are busily running all of that information through their databanks, and in a few hours, they'll be rolling up whatever networks you've established here and elsewhere." The ache in Jiang's rear ribs continues to throb. His stomach is roiling with nausea. "The Americans are making demands," Li says. "They say you interfered with the rescue of the president's daughter. They say no talks, no movement on improving our relations until your status is settled, Jiang Lijun." He's starting to sweat. His mouth has a metallic taste.
"Settled how?"
he asks, surprised at how weak his voice sounds. "Permanently," his boss quickly replies.
"Sorry to say, you will never leave the United States."
Aghast, Jiang says,
"You're turning me over to the Americans."
Li shakes his head.
"Of course not. I would never do anything like that to one of my officers."
Jiang's vision is getting blurry. He looks at the desk. Li's drink remains untouched. Softly, his boss says,
"Not bad for a fat mushroom, huh? Think of this, my dear Li Jun. When this is all settled, you will be a hero, like your father, and the party will take care of your wife and your daughter. That I promise."
Jiang tries to speak, but his tongue, jaw, and soon, everything else, won't.
work.
Chapter 136. Family Quarters, the White House. President Pamela Barnes is alone in the living room area of the White House's family quarters, bare feet up on a hassock, sipping her daily Glenlivet on ice, watching the news coverage this late afternoon on MSNBC, the sound off. The past several hours have been grueling. Barnes refuses to watch any news coverage with the sound on because she can't stand the joyful and congratulatory words coming from the weasel mouths of the news anchors and the military and special forces experts who've come on to discuss in awed tones the unauthorized yet successful mission by Matt Keating to rescue his daughter. And what of the Barnes administration? Hell, what else can she do but issue a cheerful press release praising Matt Keating and his crew of unnamed warriors, including that dead Secret Service agent who's about to come home? Up on the screen is live footage from Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. An Air Force jet has just landed, and six Marines in dress blues have marched up into the rear of the aircraft and are now marching down, carrying the flag-draped metal coffin of former Marine and deceased Secret Service agent David Stahl. She takes another bracing sip. Some hours earlier today, word came to her Deputy Chief of Staff, Felicia Taft, from Stahl's parents and his congressman from California, that no member of the Barnes administration would be welcome at the Dover Air Force Base ceremony. Instead, standing with the head of the Secret Service, and not the Secretary of Homeland Security, are Matthew Keating, Samantha Keating, and Mel Keating, sitting calmly in a wheelchair. Beside them are various members of the Secret Service and the Stahl family. What an image. What a sight, as the casket is solemnly taken out. Richard, she thinks, I sure could use your advice today. But Richard is out in Iowa, trying to make nice with some dairy farmers who are upset with her administration's latest trade policy. The Iowa caucuses are coming up sooner than anyone thinks, and she needs to get ready for the challenges of running for a second term. Barnes gets up and goes to a small desk. She looks back at the television screen. There's a graphic of northwestern Libya depicting a raid by army rangers on the compound where Asim al-Ashid lived. And the news is that a number of important documents, blueprints, and computer drives have been seized. Good news, all right. But not particularly for her. She opens the center desk drawer and takes out the buff-colored envelope she found in the Resolute desk on Inauguration Day, more than 18 months ago. She slips out the handwritten note on White House stationery and rereads once more the words from her predecessor, following an Inauguration Day tradition nearly 40 years old.
Dear Pamela, my sincere congratulations on your victory following a historic political battle, well fought in the tough arena of today's heavily partisan environment. Today, you become the president of a proud and good people who are truly decent in their hearts and actions. They long for an America at peace, that knows prosperity, and that is a leader in the world. You have my prayers, support, and good wishes for the challenging months ahead. You are starting an incredible journey, experienced by very few over the years, and you should feel honored that the American people have chosen you. God bless you and your family. Sincerely, Matt Keating.
Barnes pauses. Oh, if that damn seal had just stopped there. But he didn't.
P.S. Notwithstanding the above, Pamela, I plan to see you again, face to face, in 4 years.
Barnes takes the historic note, crumples it into a ball, and drops it on the floor. She finishes off her drink, decides it's time for another.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The President's Daughter, written by Bill Clinton and James Patterson, read by David B., Fager Al-Kaisi, James Chen, Jeremy Davidson, Amanda Dolan, Peter Ganem, Dion Graham, January Lavoie, Mary Stuart Masterson, and Sunila Nankani. Produced by Michelle McGonigal. Directed by David Rapkin. Edited by Danny Meltzer and Wesley Swinnen. Mixed and mastered by Danny Meltzer. The President's Daughter is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group, and Alfred A. Knopf, a division of Penguin Random House. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. For more Penguin Random House productions, visit us at penguinrandomhouse.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by James Patterson and William Jefferson Clinton. Audio production copyright 2021, Hachette Audio and Penguin Random House. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group and Penguin Random House support the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.